Welcome to the Daily Path Podcast, where it's all about building an authentic life and business. I'm your host, Joe Winters Jr., and now for today's message. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Daily Path Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Winters Jr., and today I am joined by Daniel Gagnon, who is the co-founder of Agile Leader Academy, where they help leaders develop their abilities to lead change and to build adaptive and value-based organizations that thrive in a fast-changing, unpredictable environment. Today, we're going to be talking about leading change to build value-based organizations. Daniel, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Joe. It's an absolute honor to be here.
So today I would like to talk to you about, you know, how you transform leaders, organizations, and how you got to where you are today. So please start by telling us what and why you do what you do at Agile Leader Academy.
Well, I can go with the wider philosophical thing first, and then we can get into actual practical details. But for many years now, in fact, most of my career, I've gotten up in the morning with the firm intent that I wanted to touch at least one other person's life and improve it. And if I could go to bed and that was accomplished, that was a great day. It's always been about people for me in every work situation, every life situation I've found myself in. It just came naturally. I won't claim any credit. I didn't have to do anything or force myself into this mindset. It was always there. So I roll with it. So with that in mind, that is my vision. That's what gets me up in the morning, you know, improving people's lives. And over the course of my career, if I concentrate on the last 20 years or so, a lot of time in project management, project portfolio management, discovering the Agile movement about 15 years ago, and just looking at how organizations work and how people work within organizations. To me, that's been it's been an ongoing journey of discovery, challenging journey of discovery and learning. And I learn every day, and every day is another opportunity to fulfill my mission. So,
I love that. Thank you for sharing. Would you say that? So, before you got into your line of work, I'm curious. Did you have a mentor or someone that you know, impacted your life that you would say kind of inspired you to have that mission for yourself to wake up each day and be able to impact someone else's life, or, you know, not so much who impacted your life, I guess, really, that kind of inspired that in you?
I guess a lot of people, and, but I do remember one specific incident. Boss, basically, back in the 90s, he'd hired me into a fairly senior position. And the reason I'm recounting this particular episode is because it speaks to the practical side of helping people be happier and happier at work. So after hiring me, he said he was going back to, it was back in the dot-com days. It was a multinational sort of outfit. He was going back to London, England, after having hired me to take his place here in Montreal. And as we were having dinner the night before he was due to return to London, he looked at me and said, "By the way, Daniel, I'm leaving things I know in good hands here, but I'd like to tell you one thing. I will be checking up on you from London. And if I find that you're putting in excessive hours and doing all kinds of overtime, I'm going to conclude one of two things. Either you're not sufficiently using the powers of delegation that you have, or you're simply inefficient. Either way, I won't be very pleased." And it dawned on me, and this is what brings me today to, you know, and we'll get to this later. He was warning me against hero culture, the hero leader, the self-sacrificing hero leader who takes everything on his or her shoulders, but in the process disenfranchises, disempowers, and destroys the agency of those below them, so to speak, in a hierarchical sense. But that dinner, already I was very, you know, but people-oriented, but he was teaching me that the trap of too much of a people orientation can be self-sacrifice, and self-sacrifice then breeds heroism. Heroism then breeds egotism and narcissism. It's an incredible cycle. he warned me off that, and I never forgot that lesson, and it just stuck with me.
Wow, that's
And that's
interesting. And that's a deep lesson to learn at very early, because I think that, like, in at least my generation, like, hustle culture was like something that was highly praised, right? And to hear it as he said it to you, I think more people within hustle culture should hear that, because one thing I've kind of come to realize is that putting in long hours does not necessarily mean you're getting more done. That is something
Does
that
not.
I have learned. You can certainly burn yourself out. You can certainly sacrifice, meaningful relationships and experiences with family and friends, as a result of, not using the power of delegation, or being inefficient, so to speak. And so that's a phenomenal lesson. I wanted to ask, to kind of piggyback off of that, like, is that something that you teach to those that you lead? And two, if so, how do you get other leaders to, I guess, have that breakthrough? Because it's very easy to think more work means better production when that's not necessarily always the case.
Absolutely. So the approach we take with leadership with Agile Leader Academy and our work with leadership teams and with individual contributors as well, middle management and so on. But the overall approach in teaching this and getting sort of them to open their eyes to this fact is we do have some training and some coaching around the notion of vertical development. Now, vertical development is basically it's a couple of things. It's a line of academic study in social sciences that goes back many decades. And what it essentially says is that all humans go through various stages in life. And if you apply that to business, there are two main thinkers in leadership in the realm of leadership. Well, actually more, but the ones that I draw the most inspiration from perhaps are William Torbert and Bill Joyner. And they basically proposed a model whereby you, let's say you're a leader just starting out. It's your first leadership job, right? Well, chances are you're there because you were good at the actual job you do. You had expertise in your field. And in order to keep you, because you've gotten so good at this, you're getting competing offers and so on, and you're probably in an organizational situation where HR can't, people resources are at the limit of what they can pay you as an individual contributor. So, bam, you're promoted to a manager. Most of the people to whom this happens didn't really want to become managers. They wanted to continue to ply their craft, but it comes usually at a time in early adulthood when you're founding a family, you've got big financial obligations, so on. So most of us, and it's happened to me as well, most of us take the promotion, right? But it often leads to unhappiness, and the only time that we're happy in these situations when the door is closed and our direct reports aren't bothering us and we're actually able to get back on a file, right? So that's what's known as expert leadership. And it goes on and on. It goes to achiever leadership, which is sort of the politically savvy sort of next phase of towing the company line, being very inspiring, but basically playing the game of corporate, being a good corporate citizen, being a good corporate leader, getting others to buy into your vision and being ambitious of yourself and your team. This is what is held up as the paragon of leadership still in the corporate world today. It's what MBA, most MBA and business schools are still producing. It's what the majority of most leadership development programs are all aimed at, this achiever leadership, whereby, and this is heroic leadership at its best, right? You've got achiever leaders who I've heard achiever leaders be proud of the fact that, they can't take their bank vacations or they've worked 70 hours this week and so on and so forth. Comes back to the comment my boss made, right? They're not delegating. And they're being inefficient, but it's held up as a paragon of virtue and a paragon of accomplishment. The next stage is what we try to get leaders is aware that exists, and that's what Bill Joyner calls the catalyst stage. And this is the leading edge of leadership that you read about a lot in social media: the empathy, the vulnerability, the intellectual intellectual, not the but emotional, emotional quotient and so on. Studies have shown time and time and time again that, only about 10% of leaders worldwide, across divisions, across types of organization, operate at this level even under pressure. About 55% are at the achiever stage and 35% at the expert stage. This vertical development is should not be seen as you've become a catalyst and now you're a kumbaya, everything's great. You can still exercise situational leadership because basically each successive stage honors and includes the good things about the previous ones. So there's getting people aware of this model as opposed to what is taught in most leadership development programs, which is horizontal development, increasing skills, increasing competencies, going deep down on, more traditional models. But vertical development is we've taught and coached, hundreds and hundreds of people on this approach now, and it always creates an awakening. It takes a long time because time is the only thing that can be utterly and completely depended upon to marches through these stages, but that time can be compressed by awareness and be by changing our habits. Simple things like if you're a heroic leader, try not to be the one to speak first in a meeting with your direct reports, because then you've anchored the meeting to your views. So that would be the from the from a leadership side, the main sort of tool that we have at our disposal. And that we use and have used successfully with many types of organizations. And it's very different from, and again, if you look at large organizations today, they like to pick out high potential candidates and put them through this these series of programs, all aimed out to churn out a better achiever leader. Now, there's nothing wrong with any particular phase of leadership in as much as, they're all necessary in certain situations. But the idea is as you move up through these stages and you conclude the good things about the previous ones, your toolkit is far deeper and wider. And you can, you may have a team of beginners that you're starting. Well, you're going to be more expert with them and show them maybe, give them some tricks from some trade craft with an H with or with another team, you may have to be more of an achiever, get them motivated. But with other teams, you can let them go more.
It's
There are other
it's
stages beyond that, but they're like superhuman.
yeah it so it's it sounds like what you're saying is that as you are transcending from one stage to the next stage, that does not necessarily mean that the stage you have transcended from is less than, but rather you would exercise different stages with different people based on their unique needs. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Precisely, and you could actually find yourself switching among all these stages multiple times a day.
Certainly make, that does make sense. I mean, because your relationship with one person would be different with your relationship with another person. The needs of one person would be different, than the next person. So that certainly makes sense. Here on your journey, you have realized that transforming an organization to be more agile is a journey that must begin with leaders becoming aware of their own limitations and biases and learning to let go of the details while still providing vision and guidance. What would you say are some more of the common pitfalls that prevent leaders from becoming aware of their own limitations and biases? Like it sounds like, for example, one of them would be, just simply wanting to be a heroic leader and never going beyond that point. Like I could see how that is a pitfall that prevent them from, being aware of their own limitations and biases at that stage, right? But what are some other common pitfalls that prevent leaders from becoming more aware?
Well, one of the most common ones that we find when we do these awareness sessions and when we coach our leaders is oftentimes you'll get a leader who is now becoming aware of this, but she's the only one in her department. She's the one only one in her division. And all of a sudden now there's peer pressure because the others are going, what's the matter with Marcia? She's not following the game plan anymore. She's going all soft. She's making us look bad. So how do you summon the courage, the personal courage to start changing your way of relating to teams and people and other leaders when you're actually being a trailblazer. And what we do tell people in that situation is you can always begin. There's always a 15% bubble of, I would call, opportunity or bubble of independence around you where you can act with relative autonomy and start making something happen. And eventually, and what I've seen happen is that when a leader is the only one in her division that starts acting this way, what happens is her teams notice it. I have one client who actually got the best 360 ever seen historically ever in the company he was at. And because he was adopting more of a catalyst attitude with his team, and that started curiosity as it went all the way up to, the head of human resources went up to the CEO and said, what's happening? Why is this the best 360 all of a sudden? When they started to investigate and talk to him and talk to team members, they realized, well, he's acting differently with his teams. He's giving agency. So you can always start. So that the first, misconception is I'm alone. I have to basically toe the line and be quiet. So it's a question of, another thing that gets a lot bandied around a lot on social media these days, and sometimes, unfortunately, shallow ways, the concept of psychological safety. Is it safe for you to start acting more benevolently and more openly towards your direct reports in an atmosphere which is more intent on grinding out performance from the workforce?
Let's pin right there, and let's say someone says, that is their reality in their workplace. Like their direct report, like their higher ups, is more about them grinding and less about them being able to speak how they feel or contribute to the workplace intellectually, so to speak, right? Like, how would you recommend someone going about that conversation with their higher ups to create a more safe space so they can be able to have these conversations? Because I would imagine that, and this is just my perspective on it. I mean, you could tell me if you say it differently, but I think that there is never a better time to speak up. Like the moment I feel like it's like I firmly believe that no matter if it's in the workplace, in the community, in your family, the moment that you feel as if there's something that needs to be spoke up about, the time is now. Now, maybe if you need to take a few days or weeks to think about how you're going to speak about it, then okay, great. But that's more of like you trying to figure out how you want to go about it instead of saying, you know what, there's going to be a better time to do it, and that's just going to be later for whatever X reason. So if someone was going to speak up, sooner rather than later, how would you go about, recommending, how would you recommend they go about that, creating that conversation, having that conversation with their higher ups?
First thing I want to say is I completely agree with what you said about there's never a good time to speak up and better time to speak up than now. To me, when it comes to dysfunctions and pain in the workplace, silence is assent. It is that simple. And so the way to go about it, also that I've seen work, is usually when you're witnessing these situations, the odd thing is that I've rarely seen it. That these dysfunctions are rarely because of malice. They are more often than not a cultural dysfunction that has been, just passed on from decade to decade, and people model the previous leadership model, types of leadership they've seen. So very rarely, very few people actually get up in the morning intent on doing harm. I mean, some might, but never attribute to malice what can be attributed to, in this case, a lack of awareness. But that being said, you can't talk to your other leaders or even your boss and use the language of a catalyst leader if they're at a level that is, more achiever, expert. So the way to go is to use the language of the, because you have you still have that level within you, go to that level and sell the sizzle in terms of, you say the reason we don't, the reason we want people to feel agency is because that's how we get to innovation and thrive as a company. The reason we want people to challenge and speak up is that's how we create better products and outpace the competition. The reason we want people to just, point out waste and redundancy is that, makes us more effective in our flow and therefore gets value to the customer sooner and faster. You can't just make it about, well, it would be nice and talk about very lofty humanistic goals if the people on the receiving end of this have not evolved to a state where they can easily relate to those values. And again, it's not from malice, just from a lack of awareness. You can't give people you can't electroshock people into the next level of development.
Yeah, that no, that makes sense. So let's kind of shift perspectives here. Let's say I mean, an entrepreneur that is looking to provide speaking and coaching to, larger organizations. When, and let's say they I guess want to learn from you how to go about, being able to work with those type of organizations from your experience, right? Like you've mentioned, you've worked with hundreds of organizations at this point. Like when an organization hires you, what is the step-by-step process you follow to get your client's results? Meaning like, from the moment they become a client or their prospective client to the moment they become a client to, I don't know, like the first point of like progress in the relationship. Like and how do you measure that progress? Right. So like how does that look for you and your organization?
Absolutely. So usually when I'm in touch for the first time with the client, I like to gauge their level of readiness to actually put in the work that's required of them in order to make this happen. Because the first thing I tell them is this has to come from within your organization. It has to come from you. It has to come from your coworkers. It has to come from leadership. And contrarily, perhaps, to a Big Five approach where everything will be taken care of, and you've got these hundreds of pages of PowerPoints. And oh, by the way, we're going to follow up with workforce augmentation and so on. At Agile Leader Academy, we're the tip of the iceberg of an alliance of, as I mentioned, of basically senior practitioners, across many places in the globe. And we will basically only involve the specialists who can really help you at the time and at the stage you're at, and only in terms of, teaching you to fish rather than giving you a fish. So first thing we check is, are you ready to do this? If you are, we're going to look at your organization, and we'd like to interview basically a cross section of leadership. Just a few questions, the same questions for everyone. That gives a sense of where people are from vertical perspective, what their challenges are from an operational perspective, but also from a strategy perspective. And also we'd like to use something. Once we have these interviews, we look at what's going on. We'd like to use something we created called the Transformation Alignment Canvas. And basically, it's a simple grid with an X and a Y axis with impact and scale. And we look at the various things that may be going on already in terms of change or transformation initiatives in the company. So typically, what we see in somewhat larger organizations is, you'll have IT who are pursuing better and faster automation. You'll have HR, people management, who are perhaps running a DEI program. You have the CEO who has maybe spoken out about psychological safety. You'll have the PMO who are very much concerned with, making projects arrive on time, on budget. And so on. You'll have governance. You have governance players. You'll have basically, you may have even a Lean Six Sigma team that are looking at, it goes on and on. But all these things are all started with good intent, but they're siloed, and the overall effect is change fatigue and a house divided. It's as if a sports team, the offensive players, would rather lose 5-4 than win 1-0, because at least when they lost 5-4, it means the offense is producing. Or the defensive players would rather lose, rather lose 1-0 than win 5-4, because if it's 1-0, their defense is good. They only let one in. Don't care about the offense that's not producing. That's not our department. So a house
Interesting.
divided. So when we see that, we basically try to get them into collaborate and connect mode, and just create an awareness around how all these things are basically pulling things apart. And they're creating an incredible tax in terms of people's mind space, because people are getting bombarded by emails and meetings and newsletters about all these different initiatives going on. I'm rambling on. I'm wondering about the gist of your question was rather how to go about this, or
No,
sort of
like in your
my process.
onboarding process, that step-by-step process, which I was going to stop you there, and I was going to ask you two questions. The first one was stage one, you assessed it to see them as the leader, their level of readiness, and to also assess if they have the problem that you or one of your specialists within your alliance actually can solve. So my question there is, if the answer is no, let's say they they don't actually need your firm for a particular problem per se, but they have problems, just not one that your organization is focused on solving. In that case, like, do you turn them away as a client, or recommend them out to someone else in a completely different company? Or do you take them on and try to solve that problem? And I'm asking because we have entrepreneurs that feel like, take on the client just to make the money and try to solve the problem. And then you have some entrepreneurs that are more on the side of, you know what, we know the problems we solve, and we only focus on the problems we solve. And as a result, we turn away those who don't have the problems that we solve. What's your take on that?
So it depends on the context. I'll say that I've done all three approaches. So I have referred them to companies and other organizations that really focus on the type of problem they have, and sometimes there's a very clear fit. I'm glad to do it, and I know they'll be in good hands. Other times where basically, no matter which way I slice it, I can't see how getting involved with that particular client, will actually either help them. It may not, there's a very low chance of it being able to reach a point where it actually helps them, and it also detracts from our focus. There have been times, however, and times once or twice where I've been actually very happy we did, is there was just a gut feel. It's almost impossible to explain, but there was just a gut feel, maybe in the quality of the relationship, maybe in the openness of the mostly the openness, and people can be not ready yet very willing. And if I feel that there's a high amount of willingness, the readiness can be improved. And what
I agree.
if we typically do in a situation like that is we'll come in and propose a very small engagement, a very test, let's just test one first step. Let's do a couple of interviews. Let's just try that. Let's see and get a feel for the place, get a feel for the other folks in the organization. So that has happened. So I've been satisfied with the results of doing all those three things. I've second guessed myself at times, so many times when I've, oh, I shouldn't have referred him. I should have taken that one on. I should not have taken this one on. Oh, I should have not, I really should have given those guys a second chance. And it depends on where you're at in your own journey as an entrepreneur as well. I mean, I'm at a certain age, a certain level of comfort. I cannot here blithely sit here and tell entrepreneurs who are just starting out that, young family, oh no, you have to be picky about your clients. Well, it's a question of, paying the mortgage and putting food on the table, but just take all the clients you can and do the best you can and learn.
Certainly. So
That's
now your second step is you then go to have conversations with their leadership team. Like, you want to see if others in the organization are, invested in this process. Have you came up against organizations that say they deny that request? And if they do deny that request, for you and your organization, do you continue pursuing working with them, although they've denied the request of you being able to interview their executive team before working with them? Or do you turn them away because to you, that part of the process is essential and has to be done before working with someone? Like, how, like, does that make sense for that second step?
It does. It does. And what I could say to that, basically, again, from experience, is, I like the expression deny access. When you are denied access as an outside actor, what that tells you is that the door through which you came to access the organization in the first place had limited sphere of influence
Okay.
and an almost more limited zone of control. So you can do one of two things. You can continue working with the original hiring client and try to help them expand their zone of influence. Or if that is not possible, just finish up whatever you had contracted with them in terms of a middle-ish result that is still a result that is still measurable, and bow out gracefully, but keep in touch because there might be, might be a second chance. And funnily enough, some of our business comes from people whose zone of influence we couldn't help and we bowed out, but then they change company and they have a bigger zone of influence somewhere else. So I have clients that follow me or clients that I follow, which is fantastic because it's also a loyalty, a network, and becomes a friendship thing. So before tossing out a contract where you realize that your current client's zone of influence is limited, see how you can help them expand that, and draw them into your network, and maybe become loyal to each other, and who knows what happens down the road.
You know, it sounds like building a meaningful network means a lot to you.
Oh yeah.
How would you express the importance of building a meaningful network?
I think it has been the most important thing in my career.
How so?
Because if I look at how I've derived my livelihood, how I've enjoyed the contracts that I've enjoyed versus those that I, have derived less enjoyment from, the contracts that I've grown in, most of the time, those engagements had to do with someone from my network, one way, shape, or form. So your network knows you, knows your abilities, and they're actually the ones that are sometimes most likely to challenge you and bring you in on something that's at your growing edge, and they're aware of it, but they trust you. And that trust is what is the fuel. Is the fuel to trying different things and having more and more opportunities. So maintaining and creating that trust, and yeah, the network to me has been, I mean, other people's experience may vary, but to me, the network, the loyalty and the trust and the commitment, the sense of two-way commitment as well. Like I've also been in situations where I have taken some things on because I was more committed to that member of my network and I wanted to help them through what was obviously a rougher spot they were going through in their organization. So from time to time that has happened. And that again is establishing two-way loyalty.
You know, networking is extremely important. I think it's one of the greatest assets to anyone's career. So what are some of the personal development practices or principles you have for continuing to grow and being able to show up as the coach you need to be for your clients?
I like to go to bed a little more ignorant every night. So that means that I've learned something, I've come across a notion that I was unfamiliar with or not familiar with enough, and I dig and dig and dig. I've been reading an average of a book a week since the age of 8.
Oh, wow.
That is insatiable. I'm a lifelong learner. So anytime anything piques my interest, there's a chance that 2 days later I'm reading a book on it. Or now, in more recent years, or it could be a blog or a video or whatever, but webinars, I reach out to authors, I reach out to practitioners, I reach out and I ask questions. I'm just, I'm a generalizing specialist. I'm not, I have, a bit of knowledge about a lot. That's hence the network idea too, where I can come in and reconnoiter the terrain, see where deeper knowledge than my own specific area resides. So learn to be able to recognize patterns, learn to be able to recognize limitations of your own knowledge and own competencies and skills. And again, if you go to bed a little more ignorant every night, that's a big win because it means you're paradoxically, it's a paradox, but it means you're expanding your knowledge.
Interesting concept. So what's next for you? What is your vision or number one business goal for the next 3 years?
Number one business goal is to impact as many people in a positive way as I can by helping the organizations be, safer, happier places that where value flows better to the customer. And the way to do that, the big lever to do that, I spent a lot of time working with teams in the agile space for project management, project teams, and so on. But with Agile Leader Academy, the reason we founded this is that the true lever that unblocks access to more hearts and minds and changes more lives, that lever gets bigger and more impactful the higher you go in the organization. So I'd like to work with more and more executive level and C-suite clients to be able to really work on their vertical development, because that will trickle down in sense of, if you have a very aware leader at the top, he or she will basically push for awareness and hold down through the hierarchy and create a a middle management layer that is also committed to providing people with agency and the ability and willingness on the part of teams and individual contributors to bring their full selves, their full minds to work. And we've all seen the Gallup numbers, right? Year after year after year, 80 to 85% of people in the world are completely or partially disengaged from what they're doing. Those numbers don't budge, and Agile didn't change those numbers, and Lean didn't change those numbers, and the pandemic, it got worse. So I think that the fundamental things are the cognitive biases and the awareness of vertical development and the awareness that we can't just keep on tweaking achievership, leadership, and heroic culture. It cannot be tweaked. It has to be replaced and changed. So that's what I want to do.
I'm certainly sure you'll do exactly what you want to do. Have you ever considered starting a podcast? I mean, when you talk about wanting to impact as many people as possible, podcasting and things like a YouTube channel like are very impactful and in alignment with that goal. Have you ever thought about that?
I have, and with when my business partner in Agile Leader Academy, we do have occasional webinars, but the idea of a podcast might not be actually banned from our future. I'd like to give that some thought.
It certainly sounds like that would be very beneficial to the vision. If there was a principle or practice that you weren't able to share today and would like to share, what would it be?
Well, it's related to the vertical development piece, and just as individuals can have levels of development, and many listeners are probably aware of this, but there's work by a guy named Frédéric Laloux, a book called Reinventing Organizations, and it sort of mirrors the personal vertical development model with a vertical development model for organizations. And I have found in my work that you can actually look at where the majority of leaders, and by leaders, by the way, I've been using that since the beginning, we both have, but there's leaders and there's leader full organizations. So not all leaders are managers, not all managers are leaders. So you don't have to be have a hierarchical position to be a leader. Just anyway, there's a de definite correlation between the level of development of the organization and the level of development, sort of the median level of development of most of the leadership team. And it makes you, when you establish that link, it makes you realize that, for example, in our transformation alignment canvas, if you're starting to work in an agile way in a small IT team, that's not going to have any impact because the overall level of the org, it might speed things up a bit in certain projects and products and so on. But overall, the culture won't change because if the overall leadership is, for example, orange, which is, the equivalent of achiever, you're still going to be in an achiever slash orange, an orange organization full of achiever leaders, right? So until the mindset changes, it's the mindset of the individual leaders, their level of development over time that has to shift. And then the overall color of the organization will shift alongside with that. So these things need to be studied in tandem, I firmly believe.
Thank you for sharing. Do you have somewhere that my listeners can go to get access to the lever that you're referring to, or the levels of leadership that you're referring to? Like, do you have somewhere you would recommend they go, a website or your social media, or where would you recommend?
Yeah, so on LinkedIn, so Daniel Gagnon, Gagnon. I'm sure you'll put that in the show notes. On LinkedIn, in
Absolutely.
my featured section, there's a whole bunch of webinars, podcasts, so on that I've done over the years. There's some material there. There is a bit of material in on our website, agileleader.academy. And in terms of someone who wanted to really explore the vertical development model, what I would most recommend is actually a book by Bill Joyner called Leadership Agility. It's just on his website is changewise.com. Bill Joyner is still working, going strong. He's my main sort of reference for this, for all of this. So, Leadership Agility, the book, it's a really fascinating read because it features, amongst other things, an interview with an imaginary leader, but at five different stages of vertical development, asking that leader the same questions. And you see in the answers the embodiment of what these levels look like.
Interesting.
That alone is worth the price of admission.
Completely agree. And I will be including those links in the show notes. Daniel, thank you for joining me on the podcast today.
Oh, it was an honor and a pleasure.
And to my listeners, I hope you take something out of this interview today and implement it into your daily path. Until next time, have a blessed day. Thank you for joining us on this episode of the Daily Path Podcast. If you would like to launch your own podcast show to expand your reach, grow your network, and sign more premium clients for your business, visit dailypathacademy.com to learn how we can help you launch an impactful podcast that changes lives around the world and acquires high-ticket clients for your business. That's dailypathacademy.com.